This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
You're listening to an irreverent podcast.
For more unholy content from our friends, head to irreverent.fm.
Hey friends, welcome to the Speaking in Church podcast. I'm Josie, and today is another treat for me. I mean, everybody's a treat for me, but this is my nerd. These are my nerd treat episodes, so welcome to my nerd haven. Today we are joined by David Morris from Lake Drive Books, an amazing publisher that has, you know, helped a lot of my friends. So I am a huge fan. David, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. I'm great. That's a wonderful intro. Thank you so much. You're welcome. It's amazing. It's a new thing, Lake Drive Books. So, you know, it's becoming known, and I'm thrilled to know that you know.
Oh yeah, I mean, I like to stay up to date in the publishing world as a book nerd. But tell us a little bit about you and your job and all this wonderful world of publishing.
Oh sure, yeah. Well, I've been in publishing almost 30 years. I can't believe it. I thought I was going to be a psychotherapist. I have that voice, you know?
Yeah.
And I thought I was going to be a religious studies academic. Mm-hmm. I have a PhD in psychology and religion.
Oh, okay. Casual.
which is like social science of religion. It's like sociology of religion. I kind of think that way. I look at religion sort of in a kind of pragmatic objective. I've tried to look at it from objectively from outside looking in, but have always been a participant because I grew up evangelical. but my education, my grad studies work helped me put language to the background that I have, that so many of us share and we're trying to find words for. So it gave me a certain language for that. It's very specific, but it's good. But there's not a lot of academia as its own thing, and always kind of living between two worlds of psychology and religion. I've found myself into what's often called the accidental profession of publishing.
Yeah.
And I just kind of learned, you know, found my way. I was just paying the bills in a job for a political science textbook publisher, kind of a one person operation, called Chatham House Publishers way back when. And then I ended up getting a job working for Guideposts Books, which is part of Guidepost Magazine, out of Manhattan. I used to commute in on the train from New Jersey every day, walked right past the Empire State Building. I was there actually in 9/11, believe it or not, too, was just 22 years ago yesterday. Learned all about the different kinds of publishers that are out there, broad market, religious Christian publishing. After a good spell at that, a good 17 years, I mean, I learned a lot, got really good at writing jacket copy for one thing, because we did a lot of market testing at that, because it was a direct to consumer publishing program. We kind of acquired books that for people who were on this large mailing list that a magazine generates. It's called direct to consumer publishing, direct marketing. And most of the subscribers to Guideposts, if anybody's familiar with it, are like your grandmother or maybe even your great grandmother.
At this point.
Yeah. It's still kind of like that. But it was a captive audience. And so, you know, we would publish a lot of books, a lot of volume, more of a narrowly focused program, but a lot of volume. And we would create books, but we'd also license books from other publishers. And so I got to know all the publishers in the marketplace. That was kind of a cool thing about that job, is I got to see the whole landscape of publishing. New York, you know, going to great lunches at nice Italian restaurants in Manhattan, and having the other person pay all the time because I was the customer or
Hell
I was the client.
Yeah.
that was fun. I was wearing suits and ties in those days. And then eventually, after becoming the director of that program after so many years, I was asked to be publisher at Zondervan, which is
yikes.
Like, yeah, it's like the leading, I would argue, and maybe I'm biased, but I don't think so. I think there's studies that back this up. It's the best known brand in terms of Christian publishing, and maybe not always the most successful commercially, but it's definitely the best known, probably mostly because of all the Bible publishing that it's done.
Yeah, they make all the cute Bibles.
Yeah, the cute, yeah. All kinds. Yeah. It's huge, millions and millions of dollars every year. And then they also have published some pretty famous trade books, Rick Warren's Purpose Driven Life in particular. So when I came into Zondervan, it was 2013, and the Purpose Driven Life had been out for 10 years. So I was more of like a steward, a caretaker of its steward. Ooh, that's religious language. Sorry. So I was kind of a caretaker of it, actually kind of cleaned up some things about the book in reprints. I went from being kind of a book buyer and a person writing test copy in an office in Manhattan to having all of the, having Rick Warren's cell phone number in my cell phone where I was going to pocket dial him. And then all the literary agents, the big author personalities as far as the evangelical Christian space goes, the big dollar advances. Mm. So Zondervan was part of HarperCollins. Not everybody knows that since about the 1980s, but they let Zondervan work pretty independently as long as they're hitting their numbers. And goodness, they were with Bibles and Rick Warren. And then, the publishing business has just been rapidly evolving in the last couple of decades, which parallels a lot of my time in publishing, mainly because of the digital revolution, the loss of bookstores, the rise of Amazon. There's like all this consolidation going on. So HarperCollins bought the other really big evangelical publisher based in Nashville called Thomas Nelson. And it merged those two companies. They combined Thomas Nelson and Zondervan to call it HarperCollins Christian Publishing. And the executive committee, the executive C-suite office was in Nashville, believe it or not. So eventually that job for me, they consolidated even more. Not everybody knows this, but the publisher for Zondervan now is in Nashville. They've moved that position there. I'm staying here in Grand Rapids and have embarked on my own for the last couple of years, trying to lean on all of my experience in a very different way. I come from more of a social scientific, examined academic approach to religion, and I've always, my religion society program in grad school had a very strong focus on race, class, and gender, which isn't something a lot of psych and religion people do much with, but I did because it was part of my program. Studied homelessness in particular, so more of a class analysis.
Speaking my language here.
I'm
passionate.
Yeah. And so I think in terms of publishing, I always wanted to get back to books that are more about change and insight from the margins. One of my professors where I went to school at Drew University, Karen McCarthy Brown, well known for her book, Mama Lola, Voodoo Priestess in Brooklyn. It's an ethnography of voodoo in Brooklyn, New York. She would talk about how those on the margins are epistemologically privileged. Mm. They see reality better than white people like me necessarily. Mm. That to me in my book publishing that I do now is so important, because you hear stories and you see things and you're like, why am I not aware of this? Why is my reality shaped? Why am I just so like unaware?
Yeah.
That's my job now. I have a big passion, particularly for people who have lost their faith or struggled with faith and religion. I count myself among them. I've looked at that psychologically, and so I kind of know the dynamics to it, which gives me a lot of insight and sense of perspective as I try to publish books that reach that, you know, that by these authors that are reaching readers who are trying to find their way in this new world that we live in. So that's a long story about me, but you kind of see the arc there.
No, I mean, I like long. I mean, it was not that long, David. Come on. And yeah, it was good. It was a good story. Oh my gosh. There's so much I want to get into, but let's talk a little bit about, only because you just said this, that people that live in the margins are epistemologically privileged. I love that. I totally agree. I mean, I'm first generation Mexican-American woman who did not grow up rich. And so often I feel like even though I didn't grow up societally privileged, if you would say, like I don't have, you know, the money or the connections or whatever that other people have, I feel emotionally and spiritually privileged, because for me, the concept of like unconditional love is not that hard to grasp, where a lot of people have difficulty with that. And that is like attributed to the difficulties that I have had in life, or right. Like the resilience that everybody wants and seeks, like that just was a reality that I had to live through. And I feel like I didn't have to work too hard for, I mean, I did have to work, but it was thrust upon me, whereas, no offense to my white partner, but my white partner grew up incredibly privileged. He's tall, male, whatever, and he has a harder time with a lot of the sociological aspects of living, honestly. I mean, he has mm-hmm. all these privileges. He went into STEM, his parents paid for his school, but he can't function at a resilient level that he would like to, because he's just not accustomed to it. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah. It makes a lot of sense. I don't think you really know unconditional love, which you mentioned, until it's been tested in seeing it in adversity, in diversity,
mm-hmm.
to be able to be in conversation with someone, who's very different from you, see things differently than you, who fails you.
Yeah.
If you're a white person, you don't have that experience mm-hmm. as much.
You guys are so polite.
I'm sorry?
You guys are so polite and passive aggressive.
Oh. Well, I've had a lot of practice. I've been told how that's how.
Yeah.
I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I grew up a preacher's kid. We didn't have money.
Oh, preacher's kid. You're really in there.
Preacher's kid turned Christian counselor.
Cute.
yep. And we didn't have a whole lot of money. We were always watching our pennies. I had jobs from when I was pretty young.
Mm-hmm.
Paper out, you know, pizza delivery guy. You know, I paid my way through college. And when my wife and I first got going and, you know, first started out, I was in grad school. We finally started having kids after about 7 years. And we lived in a beat up old house in North Central New Jersey that I had to learn how to fix it. I had to get the tools. I spent a lot of time on it. And, you know, and it was like, it was actually soul nourishing mm-hmm. to have that experience. And then I live in a fairly affluent part of Grand Rapids. I mean, the cost of living here is not as bad. The housing isn't as bad. At least it wasn't 10 years ago.
Orange County is where I live.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, the mortgages are different and rents here. But it just, I'm just gobsmacked, to be honest with you, when I walk around this neighborhood and I see young families in like these homes I never could have afforded.
Yeah, truly.
And I just wonder how is this possible? You know, mm-hmm. I never grew up like this, but it's for them, it's like, this is what the water looks like. This is how the water, they don't even know it's there. That's the water there.
Yep. Yeah. And like, they just cannot see below them, right? Like people can't see below them as clearly as they can see the people above them. And those of us who grew up, again, having to fix our own houses, having to make our own way through the world, I feel like we just have more empathy for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's what comes out of struggle.
Yeah.
Let's hope.
Let's transition into publishing. I feel like this is a good, you know, we're empathetic, we're nice people, everybody, okay, we're cool here. So let's talk about the big world of publishing now that you know who we are.
Totally.
So what has been the most interesting part about Lake Drive Books? I mean, it's a small publisher, it's kind of unique. What are you facing as a company?
Yeah, that's a great, complicated question. So let's pick part of it. There's definitely some things I want to say about that. But I think it really comes down to the way the world is so segmented in the digital revolution that we're now in and that we've been experiencing. So a way I like to explain this sometimes is, 20 years ago, I used to listen to classic rock on the radio. That's how I found out about music. That's how I got to know music. Then Napster came along and blew that up. Mm-hmm. Right. And now there's like so many options. You could stream anything you want.
Yeah.
And so there's really no mass culture the way that it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Who really watches sitcoms on network TV in the evening anymore?
Yeah.
No, it's all the different streaming services and the exciting shows that everybody talks about. But you could go a couple years before you actually find out and really understand and understand Ted Lasso, for example.
Oh yeah.
You know, if you don't have that particular streaming service, you may never have discovered it. Whereas back in the days of MASH, everybody was watching MASH.
Yeah.
And so that economically and culturally has had effects. And it's multidimensional, if you ask me. But from a economic point of view, it simply means that once you get through the gatekeepers, the curating gatekeepers of media and content, you would make it. You've made it. But nowadays that ceiling is a lot higher and the people at the top, the level of culture is a lot thinner.
Yeah.
So it's like a lot of big influencers, big celebrities, not very much in between. Mm-hmm. And then a ton of us on the bottom.
Yeah.
And there was a story in Publishers Weekly, like maybe 18 months ago by now, about how all of the mid-level publishers, and we're talking like $100 million companies. That doesn't sound like mid-level to me. It sounds like a lot of money.
For real.
$100 million companies have been bought up by the larger publishers, the big five, they like to call it.
Mm-hmm.
Because those big five publishers, they're all competing for this very scarce, thin layer at the top. And they're trying to maximize economies of scale. There's just been a lot of changes that just make it more difficult for them to earn money. One of the interesting things in publishing is that with the maturation of Amazon, everyday readers are realizing that, hey, you know, I can discover this book by this author, then I can discover all their previous books.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the past, that wasn't quite as easy. You had to go with what was there at the bookstore at that time.
Yep.
So now backlist books for publishers are far more important than they ever used to be. There's a lot more revenue there, but it's also made that sort of churn and maybe even planned obsolescence of frontlist books that much harder to make money on.
Yeah.
So you're finding a lot of consolidation going on, fewer titles being published on frontlist by publishers, like where I used to be at Zondervan, for example. So there's a lot of challenges there. And I think too, that, books just don't, I mean, it's harder to get the sales. It's harder to get the unit sales. Never mind what happens at my small, new independent imprint. I watch what goes on, and I actually act as a literary agent for authors as well. I have a small list of authors where I'm a literary agent. And I watch what goes on with their books, with those authors, and I watch what goes on with other authors at those publishers. Maybe it's ranking well on Amazon in the first few weeks, but check it out 3 months later or 6 months later, okay, it's at a ranking where I happen to know they're only selling about a book a week or maybe 3 books a week.
Wow, that's so crazy that you know that. That is such so uncomfortable.
It is. Yeah. It's a lot of reality testing, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
A lot of, and I like to be honest in publishing business because there's so much mystery. There's so much narcissism, if I might say so.
Amen. Hallelujah.
What can be more self-involved than writing a book? I mean, it just comes with the
trick. I agree.
I've done it myself. So, and I get narcissistic and magical in my thinking all the time.
I'm also a writer. So I completely am like, wow, I'm so good. Yeah. This is so good.
I'm so brilliant or I'm such a horrible writer. It's either one or the other. It's nowhere in between.
Just the self-involved either way. Yes.
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So there's not a lot of middle ground. And so, you know, it is about working really hard and being patient and looking at the long game.
Yeah.
The other big challenge, the biggest challenge I face as being a ex-evangelical, progressive-minded, post-evangelical, you know, whatever labels are, you know, fit the best, is just discoverability. There's such a massiveness and organized structure to conservative evangelical Christianity in the United States. Mm. I mean, whether it's like evangelical proper, or it's more the diffuse evangelical mindset, which can even carry over into a Methodist church, which you must
know
something about. Yeah. Even into a mainline denomination. It's there whether you know it or not. Mm-hmm. You subscribe to certain sort of idealisms about religion, about faith, about Jesus, and you don't realize you're no different than the person at the non-denominational conservative church down the road.
Yeah.
There's such structure around that. And I know that firsthand from my experience and working in evangelical publishing. It is a very wealthy business. There is a high profit margin going on there. There are executives with very large salaries. And there are such resources and there's such infrastructure. That's why you'll find at maybe an Episcopal mainline church someone doing a Beth Moore study, mm-hmm. because that's what's there. That's what's available. That's what's being advertised. That's what's put in front of you in the ads on Amazon. You find that stuff. And church publishing, who does publishing for the Episcopal church, is minuscule in terms of resources by comparison. And that's not a value judgment. It's just financially and infrastructure wise, that's where things are. So, you know, the big challenge is how do you create enough revenue for a writer, for an author, for the author's publisher through enough book sales, if not other revenue streams. So that's really it. But, you know, there is hope, there is opportunity, there is excitement. One of the things I like to tell authors is that, first off, that infrastructure of the big church, capital C, is not like it used to be. Denominations are fragmenting. Mm. There are more people who claim no church affiliation whatsoever than there's ever been.
Yeah.
Things are changing in terms of the free market of religion in the United States. We are maturing as a country culturally. We're more diverse, but there's more pluralism. That's why we're seeing so much nationalism. That's what contributes to a lot of it, is people who are fearful of losing the way of life that they once knew are not happy about it, and they're acting out, speaking psychologically or as a parent maybe. Where was I? What I like to tell authors is the gatekeepers aren't there like they used to be.
Yeah.
So if you can develop an audience, it does not matter the color of your skin. It does not matter your gender. It does not matter your sexuality. It does not matter your theology or your background. If you can develop an audience, you can be successful as a communicator. you can even get big name publishers to take an interest in you, because if you've got 100,000 Instagram followers, and that's not all it takes to get a book deal.
Right.
But
it helps. Got 100,000,
if you've got even 25,000 Instagram followers and you are somebody who provides content, mm-hmm. and you have expertise, if you're just doing selfies all day long and you're a Christian music artist, that's not enough. You need more like 225,000.
Yeah.
books. But if you can do that, you can be successful and you can find your way. And some authors are figuring that out, but it's exhausting. It's tiring. Yeah. There's naysayers, there's trolls. We had at Zondervan, I was just really impressed, particularly, I mean, people don't realize this, but you know, that's thought of perhaps as a very male, pastorally kind of cultural mm-hmm. publishing house. But women took over about 10 years ago. Yeah, women authors are really where it's at, because they found each other online and they know how to communicate with each other online.
Yep.
So that made a big, big shift. But that's still conservative culture. There's still a lot there. There was a African-American author, black author that I won't name her specifically, but she definitely had a leg up. She had some famous family members, but people didn't really give her much credit. Like her book wouldn't do all that well, but she kept coming to my publishing team and saying, what do I need to do next? So podcast, grow your social media following, grow your email list. She did all of that. She worked really hard and she had help, but she really worked hard at it. And she sold 75,000 units her first year.
Hey, that's right.
Which was just amazing and surprised everybody. Did she really get a great contract after that? I think we got pretty close to it, but did we give her what we would have given someone else who hit that kind of thing out the gate? I don't know.
Right.
That's always been a question for me, but that's an aside. At any rate, so I think that, you know, the biggest challenge is discoverability. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in this evangelical world we're in, you know, there isn't a lot of media, you know, where right. there's like big followings. I mean, you would love to have a million downloads a month, right, on your podcast.
Oh!
But you can't just snap your fingers and make that happen. You know, it does happen, you know, if you're doing a lifestyle channel on YouTube or Instagram.
Right.
Or if you've got some special hook, that it's very common. But to talk about disintegrating faith.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of us. We're just not as organized. And right. and we're a little bit anti-institutional, which is kind of what we should be.
Yeah.
That's the biggest challenge right now, is trying to connect people, readers, to the amazing books that my authors are publishing.
I'm such an ideal person that I'm like trying to mentally take note of all these, like, be Beth Moore, but progressive, just bust out all of these devotionals and make your money.
Yeah. there's actually a good line of reasoning.
Nobody steal my idea. I'll do it eventually.
Yeah.
That's funny. Or, well, tell us a little bit about Lake Drive Books. I mean, I've been following you guys for a little while, for multiple reasons, but I just love the vibe. Tell us about it.
Thank you. Well, I call it that we publish books to help you heal, grow, and discover.
Mm.
It's kind of just a positive tagline, but it's really acknowledging that we have a lot of broken narratives and broken ideologies. And, we're in a phase where we need to kind of discover who we are again, discover who we've always been, maybe, and have ignored. So I'm excited to tell gritty stories, never censor an author.
Mm.
I mean, forget about censoring out coarse language. I mean, even just, you know, not telling stories as gritty as they need to be, because they really ought to be. I guess it has more of a self-help vibe than it does. Well, we just need to get to a truer form of Christ and Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is not even something Christ wanted.
Right.
it's more about how we act in the everyday world, what our relationships look like, how we acknowledge our humanity. To me, that's Christianity. That's Christian. That's Christ. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot who really want to try to keep the conversation going inside church institutions, and I support that too. I definitely there. You know, that's there's structure there. There's lives being changed and minds being changed there. But I also acknowledge that, you know, a lot of growing up evangelical, we didn't learn how to honor our own selves. Mm-hmm. And we didn't learn how to grow as well as human beings. Psychologically speaking, I study a lot about life development and psychological development and stages of growth. And if you ask me, spiritually speaking, a lot of us in the evangelical world are more adolescent. At the adolescent stage,
yeah.
We're very ideological. We're very rigid in our beliefs. Mm. We're not as, you know, we're not as mature.
You're just describing my parents right now. It's great.
Yeah.
They're stuck. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's, and I think too, that we, you know, we need to learn how to hold our spiritual sides more loosely while still valuing them. Mm-hmm. Like, I've always been envious of people of other faiths who don't have a problem talking about their Judaism or their Muslim life, mm-hmm. in a way that, you know, you don't hear Christians talking about it in as authentic a way. I mean, there's conservativeness everywhere, but somehow, you know, you're allowed to wear that identity more on your sleeve.
Yeah.
But us evangelical Christians, we kind of obfuscate our identity. No, this is just the identity, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, whatever that might be. So I, yeah, I'm kind of rambling at this point, but to get at that particularity, I think is really important in the publishing. So, you know, so we publish, we've got like eight authors out. We've signed 15, just had the first book come out a year ago, last July, a book on grief, which has done pretty well. We've
got to check it out. I'm pretty obsessed with grief right now.
Can't go wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Paying attention to what grieves you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry I interrupted you.
No, that's okay. That's okay. We have, you've interviewed Scott Okamoto on your podcast. He's a Lake Yard Books author.
Yeah. I wrote a little blurb in that one. I felt real famous. I felt real.
Yeah.
My dreams have been achieved. Forget about writing a book, a publishing book. I'm in the front of a book.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. You endorsed it. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And that's what it takes.
Yeah.
We've got a book on questions and talking to God, kind of a prayer book. We've got a couple of books talking about queer stories. The most recent one is on an intersex person.
Oh, Cynthia Baca Davis. She was on the podcast too.
There you go. Yeah. That is just like one eye-opening story.
Amen.
Yeah. Yeah. I, you know, what I like to say about this and then one of the more recent books is that you may have queer friends across the spectrum, but do you really know their stories?
Mm-hmm.
And because just our culture, our world just hides them and buries them. And they even are taught to bury their stories. So something like a memoir beautifully written by somebody like Cynthia just brings it out into the open in such a special way. And then more recently, Brandon Flannery's book, Stumbling, a sassy memoir about coming out of evangelicalism.
Ooh. Yeah, I'm interviewing him.
Yeah, he's awesome. He's awesome. He's got a big TikTok following too.
We're so connected, David. I feel like...
Oh, there you go. Yeah, yeah. And just working on more books to come. I don't want to not mention somebody, but you know, there's just really, really cool stuff. A couple of books this fall. One about overcoming childhood trauma from a spiritual director, Frank Rogers, out of the Claremont School of Theology, probably not far from you.
Oh yeah, I love Methodist Claremont
tradition.
Yeah, Claremont's like one of the best ones you can go to at the moment.
Yeah, it's a really well respected, proudly liberal school. They like to say.
Oh yeah.
And then a title called "Giving Up God" by Sarah Hen Hayward, which was her journey of deconstruction. Just a very normal person realizing, hey, this background I have just doesn't work for me anymore. not coming from an extreme situation, but just like, so, you know, all stories are good here. And then Trey Ferguson in January will be coming out. Pastor Trey Ferguson's got a large Twitter following and just really well liked. And he's got a book about theologizing bigger theology that I think people are going to love. Just very accessible to read, a lot of fun. Fun is important in all this too.
Yeah. I agree.
I try to remember that.
What's the point of books if there's not going to be fun?
They have to be readable, right? Yep. And you have to actually enjoy the writing. I've got one author that we're getting close to on a proposal, and her thing is comedy writing.
Yes.
And she's been really earnestly concerned about the strength of the writing in general. Like, does it make a good point? Does it get anywhere? Does it have good structure? I'm like, you know, a lot of that stuff is, it's there. It could be better, but you are a hysterically funny writer, completely unfiltered.
Yep.
And it's just such a joy to read you. And that's going to take you a long way right there. So just keep going.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, cause there's not a lot of comedy writing. I mean, there is, but it's not a lot. I don't know. Not a lot of it is honest enough, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll make sure you know about this book once it.
Yeah. I'm excited. Yeah. I'm very much, because of grief, I've been like avoiding all types of media that are not funny. I mean, except for politics, but I think that's hilarious too, even though it's depressing. All I consume is comedy. So I feel like more is needed from the deconstruction space, because we're all so serious. We're all so like fighting against the man. It's nice to revel in it as well, you know, and to be fun and hilarious.
Yeah. I you know, after a week of work and just being in my own Instagram account, the publishing Instagram account, Twitter, after by about Thursday or Friday, I feel like, okay, I've done my time here.
Yeah.
I gotta go watch some Star Wars.
Oh yes. Oh, Star Wars. I love Star Wars. Not as much as other people do, but I have a fond nostalgia for it. My dad actually, this is a funny deconstruction story. My dad grew up in Mexico, and when he was a kid and Star Wars first came out, they weren't allowed to go to the movies because it was the devil or something. My grandma's a little bit more extreme. And so as soon as my dad came to this country at 19, he watched all of the Star Wars and whatever was out at the time. And he loved Star Wars. He's like obsessed. Although he won't let me take him to Disneyland. He's concerned he's too old for Disneyland. But it's like, the Star Wars is there. He's like, yeah, but I'm tired.
Now. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even Star Wars to me is kind of like a modern day mythology.
Oh yeah.
It tells stories. People love to congregate around these stories and talk about them.
Mm-hmm.
I think we don't quite value what those do quite enough. I mean, they do get commercialized and popularized, especially now that Disney owns it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much mythology and power there. And I think we tend, as you know, we grew up evangelical and we tend to look at that as like the outer world,
mm-hmm.
but there's just so much value there.
Yeah.
You know, people talk about reconstructing. You should reconstruct after you deconstruct. Well, I think that a lot of the world is already constructed, and we just have to see that it's there.
Yeah. This whole notion of stories is just, I mean, growing up, I grew up in an abusive household, so I would lock myself in my room and just read. Eventually, my parents stopped taking me to the library because they would not take me back in time, so I would have so many fees. Like, I think it was like 10 cents a day that you were late, and I racked up like $60 in fines, which is not like a lot of money, but it...
At what age?
This was probably middle school. They would only let you take out 10 at a time, so I would take the 10, and then we had like a week or something. My parents wouldn't take me back in the week. I would read so fast, I'd be done with the 10 in like 5 days.
So the librarians would see you show up with your $60 fine, and they go like, what's her story?
Yeah. I mean, my teachers were like is something wrong, or are you too smart for your own good? But then I was kind of a lunatic, like, so they're like, maybe she's not a genius, but she likes to read a lot. Yeah, it was a huge obsession of mine. I mean, I tell most people I've read more books than you've probably ever read in your life. You'll find this funny. In the seventh grade, I had this teacher who loved that I was obsessed with reading. She would give me books all the time. And then all of a sudden she sees me walk in with Machiavelli's The Prince and is like completely concerned about this child reading The Prince. And wow. I would read anything I could get my hands on. I'm sure at the time I wasn't like, oh, I'm reading Machiavelli. Yeah. It was just like, this is the next thing in the library.
I think there's actually something that changes in you when you read that much.
Yes, like, I agree. Like
it sort of, you know how self-help people talk about the subliminal messages that you're imprinting upon yourself. Well, when you read that much and all those experiences and all those stories, it really makes you more articulate. The words are in your head, the ideas are in your head. You see things and perceive things differently.
Yeah.
You can express yourself better, I think.
I agree. Writing has always come so easily to me. And at first I didn't understand why. Like, I wrote my senior thesis paper in 4 hours, all 20 pages of it with the research included, because I'm just a lunatic. And I have a little bit of ADHD, so I can hyper-focus to the max. Mm. And it was like, well, how do you do that? And I'm pretty sure it's just because I've read so much that I just know how it goes. I know the process. Like I know how to say what I want to say because of what other people have already done.
Yes.
And it has made me, I feel like, more empathetic, because when you read anything you can get your hands on, you read about so many cultures, you read fantasy, you read like self-help books, you just process so much information.
Yes, exactly.
And you recognize that the world is so big and so small at the same time.
It has its patterns.
Yeah, there's nothing you can't help but be empathetic and want to learn more about what is happening in general. Even if you're not reading it in a book, you just are so used to the learning that you just get caught up in it all the time.
Yeah. What are you reading now?
Right now, this is funny. I'm reading, I think I always get the title slightly wrong. It's I'm Glad My Mom Is Dead by Jeanette McCurdy.
Oh yeah, that's on the bestseller list.
Yes, my brother got it for me for my birthday because we have a difficult relationship with our mother. And I was like, this is a little aggressive, but I will read it. turns out that Jeanette McCurdy was Mormon, which is funny because my partner is ex-Mormon. So I just find it hilarious. And it's very good. I mean, I love that I'm halfway through the book and she has spent most of this time building the story of what her relationship was with her mother. Like, she hasn't talked bad about her mom yet. Like, she hasn't done anything but show the pattern from when she was a child and how acting and all this stuff. It's like a different pace. And I really appreciate that. As somebody who has a toxic mother, it's nice to paint the full picture for people, not just fuck my mom. It's no, this is the story. This is how we got to this book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm reading that at the moment.
I just picked up Lucinda Williams' memoir. She's the Americana singer-songwriter of great stature at this point in her life.
That's fun. I love memoirs.
Yeah. I'm also reading a memoir called Open Secrets by Richard Lisher, I think is his name. Kind of more old school, older white guy kind of memoir, but he was a pastor and he's describing his experiences of coming from a very highfalutin liberal theology seminary in the Northeast to being a pastor at a country church in Missouri.
Oh.
And the sort of dissonance that he has, and
a Yankee it really, in the South.
In sort of the agitation that we're all kind of in against the dominant form of religion in the United States, it's just a reminder at how much people's identities are wrapped up in their religion. And it's not something that we can just sort of flip a switch on.
Yeah.
And how do we find our way into the new world that we're in now? The book has been a really good reminder. And this guy is just like very literate. I mean, he uses words. None of them are like really hard to understand, but I do have to look them up sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, wait, but, that's fun as a publisher.
Even the word like nonchalance, you know, Who uses that word anymore?
I know, for real.
And yet it's like, that's actually a really cool word. Why don't we use it more?
Yeah. Oh, speaking of this, I'm really curious what you would have to say, because growing up, I grew up in, you know, the hood. I grew up in a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood.
Where?
I grew up in Southgate, California. So it's okay. Near Long Beach, near Compton, Linwood. It's like that Huntington Park, all that area. Mm-hmm. I went to a nice school, but I, for so long growing up, really cultivated the way I spoke because I wanted to be taken seriously. So I didn't speak with what they would call a Chola accent. Like, most of my cousins have a Latin twinge to the way they speak. And just because that's the way we speak to each other, that's the natural course of things. And I was convinced, rightfully so, I would assume, that if I spoke that way, that I wouldn't be taken as seriously as if I had like developed my vocabulary and spoken like a white person and spoken academically. And now I've kind of gone back on that. My dad gets upset because he says that I say fuck every other word. And I'm like, well, it's like, it feels natural to me. One, because I'm an aggressive person. And two, because it feels just more personable. Like, I feel, especially in these spaces when like you have a platform of some kind, I never want people to feel like I'm above them, or I want to be like on their level. And which is not to say that everybody says fuck every other word, but I just feel like it makes me more accessible. But would you agree that it's like a hindrance, or has been in the past, maybe?
That what has been a hindrance?
The way that one speaks.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, the words you choose, the way you say them, there is all kinds of meaning attached to those things.
Mm-hmm.
And they are connected to things like race, class, gender, sexuality.
Yeah.
Whatever categories we should be talking about, without a doubt. And, you know, they're symbols, you know, and they go in different directions. At least two different directions at the same time. And they're paradoxes too, for that matter.
Yeah.
I've been in the corporate world a lot, and I would like listen to CEOs talk. Like, they've got this a certain kind of voice that really booms and gets really low. And you know,
yes, exactly.
And I learned to talk like that for a little while. I thought that was a good thing, but I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's very white itself, probably. Not necessarily, but yeah. Yeah. I definitely think, like, even just like I have a couple of Black authors in my small stable there's definitely different cadence. Every author, I like to say, has a different thumbprint.
Yeah.
And when you read their writing and you know how they talk as a person in everyday life, usually you see a connection between those two things.
Mm-hmm.
Even Lucinda Williams, as I read her memoir, I'm like, that sounds like your lyrics and your songs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The way you talk, the way you put words together. But even these two Black authors, it's like, okay, this is really different. And they don't sound white.
Yeah.
And I'm a white guy. I don't know very many Black copy editors and proofreaders. I've tried to find some. But even then, I think a lot of us are trained to do language a certain way. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no Chicago Manual of Style or for some of the writing that I'm editing. And yeah, it does apply. But, you know, you have to kind of be more expansive and almost kind of let it live on its own.
Yeah.
And let some of the rules be not just broken, but rewritten.
Yeah.
You know, for someone to say that, well, that book, that word is not in the dictionary. No, that's not true. Dictionaries are changing and being updated all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Different words are being added.
I can only imagine if Sandra Cisneros was edited like a white person. Like her literature wouldn't have made any impact.
Yeah. I love the fact that you're such a reader and you're so interested in publishing. You can write a term paper in 4 hours.
Yeah, I can.
You can get a 60,000 word manuscript done in 4 weeks.
Probably less. I actually, this is embarrassing to tell a publisher, but I self-published a book a few years ago. It was a book.
No, it's not embarrassing. Yeah. Not at all.
I find it incredibly, well, I think it's embarrassing because it's about love and it's a little aggressive. Like the poetry is a little like
poetry.
This girl's a bitch. Like it's just, and this is before I'd ever been in love. So it was all kind of like an experiment for me, but it was really funny. Yeah. I did poetry, but I am mostly an essay writer. I like essays better than poetry. But poetry, I write because I'm an obsessive journaler. So I have like 40 plus full journals of just
no way.
Yeah, wow. it's ADHD really got me.
And do you see a link between your reading and the journaling? Does it feel like it comes from the same emotion and source and desire?
No, actually it doesn't. So my reading comes from curiosity, and I find that my writing comes from me needing to get something out. Like yeah. I often tell people that if I'm not writing in my journal for a period of time, it's because I'm really struggling in life, because as soon as it's written, it's real. And I don't want things to be real, so I don't write them down. Whereas my reading, I'm just trying to get everything. Like I want to know the ins and outs of everything in the world, which I think gives me an existential crisis, which is probably then what I write down. It probably is connected.
The fact that you've journaled so much, I mean, that's what publishers like to hear, honestly, because that says that you've documented a lot of things, not just your experiences. So it doesn't have to be a memoir, but you've documented ideas and insights and observations. You notice things. That's what writing, really good writing, is all about. You know, if you were to, you probably could, you know, be a really good book writer. That longer form.
You heard it here first, everybody.
Yeah. Come on, let's figure it out.
All right, I'll do it. I've been actually have been thinking a lot about different ideas, but I mean mostly for my own edification, because I'm a project person. I need a project, and I feel like I've needed, specifically with grief. Actually, I have a friend who's been wanting to collaborate on a book. So maybe I'll just say yes.
Yeah.
It sounded a little daunting, but I was like,
well, what is like your big, what is the thing that you like to say a lot? You talked about, you've mentioned the word grief, but what is it like, what is it that your friends or you find yourself always saying to people about life, about how things work?
Honestly, I often talk to people about how I live my life without shame. Like it's the thing that people are the most curious about, especially my friends. Cause like the other day I completely was thrown over by a wave in the ocean and I did not care. Like I was not concerned with what other people like saw, like as I was flailing about, and like, how do you not, or I don't care how I look on the internet. Like if I'm recording something funny, I'll just post it cause I don't care. If somebody takes a picture of me in a group shot and I'm the one person who looks like an idiot in that picture, you can post it. I don't care. A lot of that has to do with trauma. And like, especially going to like an evangelical school, it was this notion of like, everybody's so like taboo about sex. We can't talk about sexuality because we're at a Christian university. We gotta be nice and pious. And I would have those conversations with literally anybody who would ask. Like, sex is just sex. Like, I don't understand. So that's pretty much my shtick.
Is that shame, like not feeling shame, is a negative statement? What's the positive statement? Does it mean that you understand freedom?
Yeah, is I feel completely free, which is not to say that I don't experience pain or anything like that.
Or even shame from time to time.
Right, but I don't overthink things. Like if things get messed up, okay, we'll figure it out. We'll fix it then. But I just don't play games. I don't like, no, I just, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure what kind of writer you are that you can come up with like a self-help sort of like here's the 10 steps to not feeling shame and experiencing
freedom.
How to
be a bad bitch.
A lot of those are out there already, yeah. As you might know.
Yeah.
You could write novels about that theme.
Ooh.
Or you could write more literary narratives, essays.
Yeah.
Maybe within a certain container, like The Life of Faith or...
curious about it in like a faith. Faith atmosphere. Just because, I mean, shame has always been so like shoved down your throat, and especially evangelicalism. So that's interesting. Wow, David.
That's what I like about this author who's in comedy that I work with on the agenting side, because she grew up staunchly evangelical, very restrictive, but her comedy is so unfiltered, even sexually unfiltered.
Yeah.
And it's just like, wow, you never see these two things going together.
Mm-hmm.
Although maybe in a way they actually do. They're kind of on the different sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
But she's actually letting that part out. And I say, keep it coming, because these are muscles that as evangelical minded people, we've never learned to exercise that kind of freedom within this environment. And here you are doing it. And
yeah,
it's such a good thing. And I think that's, you know, with all that journaling and all that reading you've done, you could write a great book about this topic.
All right, great. I'll work on my Instagram following to make it really worth your while.
Yeah, that's right. 25,000 at least, please.
Great. I got it. God damn it. I'll do it. I love it. Well, David, why don't you plug away at all the things you got going on right now? You can plug anything, any books coming up, anything.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Thanks so much. Yeah. Let me just mention first on the agenting side.
Yeah.
I've got a stable of authors. It's at hyponymous.com, HYPONYMOUS, hyponymous.com.
Great word.
One of my cherished authors on that side is Brad Onishi, who came out with Preparing for
Brad.
War. Yeah. Straight White American Jesus.
We're
podcast.
Homies. Yeah.
Yeah. I really have a lot of credit to him, because he's helped driven some of my other clients there. David Gushy is another one. It's been a big deal for me on that side.
Brad did a launch party at my church. We did like a whole thing.
For Gushy or for Onishi?
For Onishi.
Yeah. Thank you.
So connected, David. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, LakeDriveBooks.com, join our email list. There's, you know, I'll send you a free audiobook if you do Audible. If you join the email list, it's all there when you join. Follow my authors. It's really important that we all just stay connected and engaged and involved with each other, and spread the word about books, because word of mouth is still the number one way that people find out about books and read them.
It's true. I specifically Brad's book I talk up, because I like to shove it in a lot of conservative people's faces.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's helping sales, but it's helping my self-esteem.
Yeah. It's a good book. It's
great.
Yeah. It's like 9 months out now, and it's still amazing. It's still important with the election season coming up.
Oh, yes. Don't remind Even the rest of us. Yeah. We'll start pushing here. Yeah, thank you. Well, friends, as always, you can find us at Speaking in Church on Instagram. You can find me at Josie Takes the World for dog and crochet situations. We have merch and we have a tip jar. All of those are the link in our bio. That's it. So anyways, stay woke or get woke, friends, please, for the love of God. Bye.
This has been an Irreverent Media podcast.